Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Calcio Land podcast. So today I got my Christmas gift early. We had my good friend Andrew Barker come on to talk about Inter, all the best movies you should watch this time of year, a little bit of AC/DC. That's in the second part of the podcast. We always leave the music and film stuff last, so if you're not that interested in that, you can drop off after we talk about Calcio, but I do think you'll find that conversation very, very interesting if you're looking for some films to watch this time of year. But before we get to all that, I am joined by our great producer and co-host, Alex Goldberg. In the past few weeks, I've been putting you on the spot with some pretty tough questions. Today, I'm going to ask you something that might sound a little bit personal, but I think you'll figure out why I'm asking you this. So, Alex, I wanted to ask you, have you ever been through a really bad breakup? And if so, I wanted to know how that impacted you.
Whew. Wow. Yes, David, I have, as have, I assume, most people. My high school sweetheart, although I don't view her as a sweetheart anymore, that was a very important relationship to me at the time. I was dating a girl from out of school, David. She didn't go to my high school, so there was so much allure of, ooh, who you dating? And I was shallow and superficial, and I thought I was the shit just because I was dating her. But no, it was not a great relationship, and I broke it off. I broke it off a couple days after Valentine's Day. Not before. You don't want to be the cheapo who doesn't splurge on all the presents a couple days before. Give them the presents. Don't be one of those people. But if the relationship's not for you, it's not for you. So I broke up with her. And, that didn't really take at all. It didn't work. Let's say we dated then for another couple weeks. Then all of a sudden, David, she wanted to break up with me. And it was no longer me having the quote-unquote power, as people like to say, which is very silly. You break up. I don't care who does it. But how did I cope with that? How did it impact me? Two things. That was going into college, and I was going to Arizona State. And all you ever hear when you're an incoming freshman is the freshman 15. Don't gain the freshman 15. That I actually did the opposite. I lost about 15 pounds. Either way, I don't think it was healthy. The last way it impacted me, David, her favorite food was Swedish fish, and now I can no longer eat Swedish fish. Well, that's a lie. I can eat them now. It's been a long time. And David, you're saying this alludes to maybe something going on the more I talk. Are you asking me this regarding the rumors on Dybala's love life and how it's going to impact his play on the pitch?
Bingo. You are correct, Alex. So we've talked a lot about Dybala on the podcast. Of course, he had that amazing start to the season, and there's no way around it. He's been in a slump recently, and, he was, I don't know if we can call it being flat-out benched against Inter on Saturday, but he didn't start the match. So I appreciate your take on how it impacted you. And, one theme that when you went through a breakup, and this seems to be what is impacting Dybala's performances. And, one thing that we've tried to talk a lot about on the podcast on various players is sometimes we forget that these are human beings before being athletes, right? Like, they aren't just the players you pick on FIFA to trot out on your lineup when you play a friend or when you're doing your season. Like, these are people like you and me that have a real life, and they go do their job. And all the difference is they do their jobs in front of millions of people watching around the world. So, we forget Dybala's a young kid. He's 23, 24 years old, probably his first serious relationship. It's been up and down from what you read. So it's definitely having an impact on him. And, I remember when I was around his age, I went through a breakup that was pretty bad. It took me a while to bounce back. It impacted my job, my morale, everything. So if it's this, this is the reason for his slump. The good news is, he'll get over it pretty soon. Now that I'm older, if I talk to someone young who's going through this, I just tell them, you'll be fine. Dust yourself up and move on. And I think Juve is trying to do this. Pavel Nedved yesterday had some quotes on how Dybala needs to focus more on his footballing life, less his private life, and how everything will take off as a result. And I think there's some truth to that. So we always want to remind you guys that don't just look at these guys as athletes, look at them as human beings first. So before we get to your great Twitter questions, I wanted to do our usual post-weekend analysis and name some winners and losers from the weekend. In previous weeks, we kind of started from the earlier match, working our way to the top. This week, I'm going to go the inverted route. So as we're recording this, Atalanta's playing Genoa. I want to say that a big winners for me this week is Atalanta fans. And some of you might be wondering why I'm saying this. And in the draw, Atalanta is now going to face Borussia Dortmund in the Europa League. They previously faced Everton, and they played in Liverpool that match. Now, I have a dear friend of mine in Italy, is one of, is an ultra for my home team, Padova. He's really into, fan bases. Like, I could talk to him for hours just about how different fan bases, organized groups interact, how they do all their tifo, if you will. And he told me that, Atalanta fans are as hardcore as they come. They have a reputation for being, pretty violent, but also very passionate. And think about Atalanta fans. Their team's doing so well that in the same year they got to travel to Liverpool, the fans, to face Everton, and now go to Dortmund, a team who is known for having an amazing fan base. So I'm going to give a shout-out to Atalanta fans. They are winners in the sense that they get a second great trip. And that only happens as a result of their team performing so well. Then other winner is Torino midfielder Rincon. Had a goal yesterday. He seems to be a much better fit on a Mihailovic-type team, Torino, mid-table team, than, say, on Juve. Had a really good match yesterday. Then, of course, on Sunday, Bonaventura with a brace to give Gattuso his first win. Bonaventura has been really sensational since the coaching change. He probably was one of those players that wasn't getting along too well with Montella. Has been really energized under Gattuso, and what a difference he could make for Milan. Other winners, I thought Fiorentina was very impressive in their match against Napoli, so I'm going to give a couple of shout-outs. Their goalkeeper, Sportiello, I've always been a fan of his. Interestingly, he was close to joining Napoli not that long ago, but then he ends up at Fiorentina having a great match against Napoli. Of course, Fiorentina manager Pioli been doing a really, really good job. They're a really sized club like Fiorentina and Lazio seem to be really in his wheelhouse. And then another shout-out to Fiorentina sporting director Corvino. Did an outstanding job. Think of all the big names that left Fiorentina. He had to lower the wage bill and how well it worked out. I think, Alex, we're going to have to go look for the podcast where I said in the summer that Fiorentina may be getting relegated and Delita, because Corvino has certainly proven me wrong. We also had another great match by Chievo goalkeeper Sorrentino against Roma. Clean sheet in that match. Played really, really well. And then, of course, some winners and losers from the match between Inter and Juve. Of course, manager Luciano Spalletti. Three road games against Roma, Napoli, and Juve. They have one win and two draws to show for that. Really impressive. Goalkeeper Handanovic had another really good match. I think for Juve, we once again want to highlight a great performances by Cuadrado and Benatia. I thought Cuadrado, other than Handanovic, was the best player on the pitch. Benatia really hitting his stride at Juve. Now their fifth clean sheet in a row. Three of them came against two of them against Napoli and Inter, Champions League match, at Barcelona as well, so very impressive there. As far as the losers, we don't have too many, but a few that I want to mention. So if you're still in the camp that Serie A is boring and defensive, like, you haven't been paying attention to the league. But if you love bringing that up, if you want to trash Italian football, this was the weekend to do it. We had so many top teams involved in 0-0 draws. So this wasn't the most exciting weekend goal-wise. I think, too, the weekend with Inter and Juve drawing was really a wasted opportunity for Napoli, Lazio, and Roma. They really could have capitalized on this. I have as a loser Crotone. They lost to Sassuolo, an important match in the race to avoid relegation. We do, however, wish best of luck to their new manager, Walter Zenga, who was appointed, but I do think losing manager Nicola, who was so instrumental in their great comeback in the second half of last season, could be a big loss for them. And the last winner, loser, is VAR. Like, I still like VAR, But we can't say that the implementation of VAR has taken away controversy in Serie A. Now Lazio's threatening of taking out the team from the league play altogether. Definitely an overreaction. That definitely won't happen. But it just goes to show that just because we have VAR, controversy will still be part of Italian football. So those are our winners and losers. Now let's get to your Twitter questions, because we had a fairly long interview with our good friend Andrew Barker. I'm going to save some of the questions that you guys sent in for Thursday's show. We got some great pop culture ones, but we're going to save those since we get into a lot of movies and music with Andrew. So without further ado, Alex, which Twitter questions are we going to go over today?
All right, let's start off with a juicy Twitter question. What do you make of the recent reports on Donnarumma asking to rescind his contract with Milan, and what are the odds he joins PSG?
So I'll tell you this. We've talked about it in recent podcasts. Unfortunately, the only certainty with Milan these days is uncertainty. So we thought the closing of the sale of the club would bring some peace and we'd finally move on from that. No, there's probably just as much controversy and uncertainty with ownership as there was before. With Donnarumma, we thought the extension would put all these controversies to bed. I've said on the podcast that I really would have judged the Milan's new owners by if they would be able to get Donnarumma to resign. They did, but that in and of itself hasn't brought that much clarity. So, you know, there are reports, and these aren't on Di Marzio's side, but the reports in other places that now Donnarumma's agent, Raiola, is trying to rescind Donnarumma's contract with Milan by saying he was under psychological pressure to sign that contract. Now, that contract was almost more of a heist than anything else. Like, Raiola got a huge salary for Donnarumma, I think $6 million net a season, unheard of for a 19-year-old. If that wasn't enough, he got Milan to throw in $1 million after taxes a season for Donnarumma's brother, who's a third-string keeper. So, you know, Raiola got everything he wanted, and now he's trying to back out of the deal. What has been reported on Di Marzio's site is that, however, there isn't an exit clause, and there is not an exit clause in Donnarumma's contract. So now at least Milan can negotiate whatever price they want. We know Raiola has a great relationship with PSG. Ibrahimovic, of course, was there. He recently took over Verratti. Now Verratti's agent, Matuidi, used to play for PSG as well, another Raiola client. So it's going to be interesting. If Donnarumma leaves, I doubt it'll be in January, but it's possible in the summer that he goes to PSG because of that relationship. I will say, you know, for Milan fans, you know, the unfortunate thing is if Milan doesn't make the Champions League, we don't even know if they'd be able to reinvest the return for Donnarumma, if that money would just be needed to balance the book or, God forbid, have to pay off the Elliott Fund. So definitely not a good development for Milan. This is a big test for Gattuso, so let's see what happens with that.
Okay, moving to Inter. They're at the top of the standings. Is that just a result of the Spalletti hire, or should some credit go to ownership and Sabatini?
Great question. And someone also asked us if we should also credit a Spalletti staff more. So I think there's a really good point being made here. Yeah, Spalletti's been amazing. Probably the most important move more than any player in Serie A was him going to Inter, but I think, you know, the ownership at Inter deserves a ton of credit. They brought in Sabatini to kind of work with Ausilio on the transfer market. They took a very patient approach. They were able to meet their financial fair play restrictions without selling Perisic. They maybe didn't have they didn't have a sexier transfer window as Milan, but you could certainly say it was a lot more effective. They just targeted a few positions where they had to improve. Skriniar was tremendous. The midfield, Vecino, Borja Valero have been an upgrade there. So they deserve a lot of credit. And so the Spalletti staff, they've barely had any injuries. You know, granted, they have the advantage of not playing in Europe. But that says a lot about them. So I think Inter fans should be very happy about where they are with their ownership and their entire management team.
All right, next question brings us to the MLS. With Giovinco delivering the MLS Cup to Toronto, does he now go back to Europe to challenge for a spot on the Italian national team?
So let's look at it this way. On one hand, you can say Giovinco left Juve, comes surprisingly to MLS in 2015, wins the award for MVP, best player in the league. I'm not a huge MLS expert, but I have a hard time imagining the league ever having a better player than Giovinco so far. This year, they just won the cup. Congratulations to all our friends in Toronto listening to the podcast. So on the surface, you could say, well, what else does he have to prove now? He should just go back to Europe, show that he can do it there in a way kind of what Salah did by returning to the Premier League to show people he could do it there as well and maybe give himself a better chance to play for the Italian national team. But now I go back to what I said about Dybala. These are human beings before they are athletes. Giovinco, you know, has an amazing life in Toronto. When he was at Juve, he had to shut down his Twitter account because he was receiving so many insults. In Toronto, he's an absolute king. Maybe after Drake, he's the king of the city. He's beloved. He's raising his kid there. They have a great life. So I really wouldn't be surprised if Giovinco stays there long term, maybe even finishes his career there. But I could also see him maybe wanting to pull a Salah and show that he can do it in Europe. So an interesting situation, but again, as a reminder, look at these guys as human beings too, not just as athletes.
Did not think we would have a Drake shout on the Calcioland podcast, but we just have. All right, how is the interest in reporting different from country to country? In Italy, you have weeks of soap operas before a confirmation, while in Germany, transfers just appear out of nowhere, which reminds me of Bayern and Tolisso. Or does this have to do more with how clubs operate?
Fantastic question. Kudos to who sent it is. So I do think there's a little bit that has to do with the culture and the media in every country. Like in Italy, they love soap operas. They love drama. Like all the players that leave Serie A, even Pirlo, say, you know, how different it is to go abroad, and the media doesn't make a big deal out of every little thing. There isn't so much passion. And we see it even on Di Marzio's site. Like negotiations for transfers often become public with statements and back and forths and whatnot. But in Germany, they're much more efficient. They just cut to the chase and they get things done. I also think, too, of like when Italian clubs try to negotiate with German clubs, and they always try to do these crazy loan with option to buy deals and whatnot, and German clubs are much more by the book saying, just pay me if you want the player. So I think there's definitely a lot to how the culture works and also how the clubs operate. Like Bayern Munich's just very methodical. They just get things done. As you mentioned, the Tolisso deal, there weren't many reports. It just happened, period. So an interesting question. So I think it's a combination of how the clubs operate, but also the culture and what drives the media in each country.
With Fiorentina's ownership situation, realistically, how long will Giovanni Simeone and Federico Chiesa stay in Tuscany?
So I tweeted about these two on Sunday, like how interesting it is that both of them are like sons of established footballers, and in Simeone's case, you know, great coach now. Like Federico Chiesa's father, Enrico, is a very good striker in the 90s in Italy. Granted, he had a lot of competition at his position, but I think his son Federico is going to surpass him career-wise. So, you know, as far as Fiorentina being able to hold on to them long-term, I wouldn't say there's great hope. Like, Chiesa signed an extension, but he could always be sold for a huge profit. The De La Valle, the current owners of Fiorentina, have flirted with the idea of selling the club, so we'd have to see what happens there. There's also a project for a new stadium. So unless they get the new stadium and new owners, I don't think these guys will be there much longer. But as long as they have director Corvino, who's really great at discovering talents, they'll also be able to replace him well.
Okay, interesting question. Has Napoli hit a bad patch in their season, or is there genuine reason for concern? Is it Sarri's fault because he doesn't rotate enough?
So, Alex, you know the difference between a kiss-ass friend who always tells you everything's great, you're fantastic, you're awesome, like friends like that, and a friend who really cares and tells you the truth and how things are. I'm going to take the second approach with Sarri. I know he's not listening, but I'm going to pretend like he is. Like, you guys know how much I love Sarri. I've said all along, you know, tactically, when it comes to developing players, I really don't think there's anyone better in Italy right now, definitely the most entertaining to watch. But there's so much more to the role of a manager. And rotating players is so important. We have on the opposite side of the spectrum, Allegri going really hard the other way, resting his players a ton in the first half of the season so they can peak later in the season. And part of being a manager, you know, competing in multiple fronts like Allegri has, and granted he has a lot more experience than Sarri doing on it, is equally important than your day-to-day management. So I do have to blame Sarri quite a bit here for Napoli's struggles. It's not just the rotations, it's also how he struggles to integrate new players. Today I wrote a column on the shopping list for all the Serie A teams, and for Napoli I wrote, you know what, Napoli could even shop and buy players, but if Sarri is not going to use them, like, what's the point? So I hate to be too down on him, but, you know, Napoli has really fallen apart. To me, the match against Juve, you know, is really going to hurt them psychologically, because how many times have we seen them, not just under Sarri, but even with Benitez, be right there, and then when you think they're going to take the next step and start winning, they don't. So I hope to be wrong. I don't think this is just a bad patch. I think there's genuine reason for concern for Napoli, and it really pains me to see it. But that's the reality as I see it.
Oh, boy. Poor Lorenzo Insigne. How much does a team's history of winning come into play in their race for a title?
So I put this question after the Sarri one because I do think it does a little bit. Like, look, you know, history doesn't matter too much when you're on the pitch playing the match. You know, what happened previously I don't think has that much of an impact, but I think the culture and the environment around the teams with the fans, if there's a culture of winning, a tradition of winning, it can be a big help. So I think there is a little bit to this. You know, I'm starting to think that it's inevitable that Juve is going to win again the Scudetto, and part of me thinks, you know, when is this streak going to end? And realistically, the best answer is if when we have Inter, who seems right there, is ready to unseat them, or Milan becomes Milan again, because as much as I like what Napoli and Roma are doing, the cultures in the city, they get overly excited over a few wins in a row, and they start celebrating like they already won. I mean, in Napoli, they still celebrate the Maradona Scudetti like they happened last week. So I definitely think there's a little bit to history being a factor.
Okay, David, this will be fun. Name three players Napoli could sign to strengthen their squad.
So I'm going to cheat. I'm only going to give you two. I'm going to give you three in the sense that two for the same position. So to me, Napoli definitely needs to improve at the wing back position. Against the match against Juve, and especially against Fiorentina, they really look like they miss Ghoulam, where so much of the action comes from the left side of the pitch. They've tried to put Hizaj on that side and start Maggio. Hizaj is just not as good on that side. So to me, they need to get ideally a natural left back, and that could be Domenico Crescito, who's on Zenit. If they still want to keep using Hizja on the left, they could get Versalco from Atletico Madrid. They've been linked to him quite a bit. He'd be, you know, pretty big investment, but he'd be an intriguing option. Obviously, no Serie A did really well at Sassuolo. And the third player, they definitely need more options up front. We've seen Zielinski start in place of Insigne. Zielinski is a good player, but he's not a natural offensive winger. So I could see them bringing Inglese from Kiev, a player they already own who's on loan there. He actually has been pretty impressive. I liked what I saw against when he played against Roma. So Chievo's actually off to such a good start to the season. They're comfortably out of the relegation race. Maybe they can help out Napoli and send Inglese down there. And it would be intriguing to maybe see Milik go to Chievo and play there under less pressure. So those are, I would say, Crescito, Versalico, and Inglese are players to watch for Napoli in January.
All right, last Twitter question, and it has nothing to do with football, just the way we like it. David, how do you rate the most recent Curb Your Enthusiasm episode?
So we got some other great questions on pop culture, but because we got into it so much with Andrew, I'm going to save those for Thursday. So I included the one on Curb because I watched the season finale last night. So here's my take. I enjoyed this season more than the previous one. I don't think it's up there with the best seasons of Curb by any means. I think, you know, the ideas, the storylines, you know, are getting some of them really forced and a little bit pushed, but they were still some pretty great moments. I thought the episode with the restaurant manager on the minor disturbance in the kitchen was one of really the all-time best episodes of the series. I thought the one on the wrong text sent on purpose, when they send the text to the wrong person on purpose, was quite brilliant. I liked the finale. It was pretty good. What I liked, too, the character from Hamilton, who's supposed to be this really great, nice guy in real life, they made him into such an asshole on Curb, and I think that's great. We've seen Larry David do this over and over with a lot of famous people, so I thought that was well played. So I'll say it was like a C+, B- season from Curb. And look, you know, I love the characters so much that I could spend time with Leon, Susie, Jeff, Funkhauser, that I'll take this season all over again. So I know you're a fan too. What was your take, Alex? Do you like what you saw?
Yeah, overall I liked it. I'll agree it's not the best season of Curb by any means, but I felt like in the beginning especially the first episode of this last season, he tried almost too hard to get all of the classic Curb things into that episode, you know, the pretty good and just everything that we know Curb for. But at one point, we have a great Funkhauser moment. We have a great Richard Lewis moment where he always has to be at the restaurant before Larry. So Larry thinks he's going to one-up him, and he shows up a half hour early, yet Richard Lewis is still there. You know, so I thought that was absolutely brilliant. I love when Larry cut in line, or he saw that someone was trying to get seconds, and he completely stood up for him and said, "We do not wait for seconds." So there were some classic Larry David sayings in there, moments, situations. I loved it, but it's just so hard for me to rate like a finale like that. We already know how Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld have felt about people responding to their finales. So I think I like it, and I'll probably like it, David, even more when I watch it again in maybe like 4 or 5 months when it's already old.
Yeah, it's always better when you rewatch it. So great. So we didn't get to all the questions again. We'll answer the rest on Thursday. Now enjoy our great interview with Andrew Barker. We got into Inter first, then we transitioned to AC/DC and movies, and I think you'll really enjoy it. So after Inter's very impressive match against Juve on Saturday, and with all the movies competing for the Oscar coming out, what a better time to have our great friend Andrew Barker back on the podcast. If you've been listening to us for a while, we've had Andrew multiple times. He's a senior features writer at Variety, where he covers pop culture incredibly well, but his acumen with a football is so high that I'd have him on even if we didn't get to chat on movies and music, which you guys know is my favorite part of the podcast. So, Andrew, we are thrilled to have you back. Welcome back on to Calcio Land.
Great to be here. Always a pleasure.
Awesome. Okay, so you know how we do it. We're going to get into some Calcio first, and then we're going to transition, talk a little bit about Malcolm Young. I haven't spoken to you since he passed away, and then we're going to get into the movies. So if you're not that interested in pop culture, after I ask Andrew about, you know, how he feels about the Scudetto race, feel free to drop off. But I think you'll find the conversation very interesting if you're into movies and music. So, Andrew, last time you were on, we were previewing the derby against Milan. Obviously, Inter had been off to a very good start at that point. But I asked you point blank, you know, if you could sign today for Inter finishing in a Champions League spot without having Scudetto aspirations, would you take it? And you said you would have been very happy with a Champions League spot. I kind of felt you had the right answer on that one. But of course, you know, circumstances change. Inter finds themselves at the top of the standing. How do you feel about that proclamation now? Were you a little bit more ambitious?
Honestly, not quite. Like, I hate to sound cynical and pessimistic, especially because thus far Inter has exceeded pretty much every single one of my expectations thus far. But I still say, no, I would be happy with the Champions League place. You know, as much as we've done to overcome Juve and Napoli at the moment, I still do think that they're both objectively better squads. You know, Juve started slow, which they often do under Allegri, and then kind of get their stuff together. And, you know, Napoli started great and sort of starting to show signs of wear, I guess, as I think Napoli often does. But I still think they're better than Inter. And I think Inter is a lot closer to both of them than I would have imagined that they would have been at the beginning of the season. But, you know, after a whole season, that always separates the best squads in the end. So I would still be, I'd still have zero complaints about a very strong second or third place finish.
Interesting. Now I'll tell you this. After, you know, I felt the matches against Juve would tell us a ton about both Napoli and Inter. I think Napoli with that loss, you know, not just it's the points, but also psychologically what that means to them. I think Inter, on the other hand, you know, they have a draw on the road against Juve and Turin, never easy. They, of course, have the advantage of not being in European competition. So I don't know. I think it's going to be an interesting race down the stretch. So let's talk about that specific game. I wanted to ask you what your impressions were on that match on Saturday, and if you see this result as being just as impressive or maybe even more so than the wins Inter had at the Olimpico against Roma and the draw they had at against Napoli at the San Paolo. And this is when Napoli was really, really impressive. So give me your take on that match and how you rank it compared to those other two.
I mean, I think it is just as consequential as both of those results. I don't know that I see it as being quite as impressive. I mean, on the one hand, I will take a draw away to Juve any day. And I was completely satisfied with what happened last weekend. But, I mean, the way I see it is the match against Roma, even as early as it was probably our best performance against a top-tier side. And then the match against Chievo was like our best match, period.
Yeah.
But it was the match against Napoli was the one that really I found inspiring, and that kind of made me think that maybe this team is for real, more so than the Juve match. And maybe it's because I've already seen, you know, this Inter take on a side who I feel is objectively better than us and shut them down and get a very decent result out of it. But with the Napoli match, I mean, as you say, they really were firing on all cylinders at the time, and it felt like we knew exactly what to do with them. Like, I felt like if Napoli had beaten us in that match, it would have been because of something we would have done. You know, that basically Spalletti had us out there perfectly set up to counter everything they threw at us and maybe even to try to snatch a goal here and there. We didn't, but it still turned out well. With the Juve match, I feel there was a little bit more of the luck on our side. And clearly Spalletti knew what he was doing with that match. But there were a couple moments, you know, whether it's, I think it was Mandzukic, you know, hitting the post or a couple really big saves from Handanovic. Like, I felt like they might have deserved to win that game. And it was just sort of perseverance and a little bit of luck that got us through. But like I said, I'm incredibly happy with the way that turned out.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Inter, three away matches against the top teams. You know, they end up with a win, two draws. Very impressive second half of the season. They have all those matches at home. It's going to be a big advantage. So, Andrew, this week I've been thinking a lot about Inter keepers. Walter Zenga, who's the first Inter keeper that I grew up watching, was just appointed as Crotone manager. And the two more recent ones that I'd say really stand out are, of course, Handanovic, who's been tremendous for Inter for quite some time. And then there's Julio Cesar, who, of course, was the keeper when they won the treble. So those are two keepers I know you're very familiar with. So I'm going to put you on the spot, Andrew. If the outcome of if your life depended on the outcome of a match and you could have just one between Handanovic and Julio Cesar, who do you want as your keeper?
Man, my life on the line. All right, I would actually go with Handanovic. And I mean, look, I would say that for all the upheaval and turmoil, the one thing I can't complain about as an Inter fan is that the team has always had world-class goalkeepers as long as I've been watching them. I mean, I go back to Francesco Toldo, was my first one, and he was great. Julio Cesar, Handanovic, like, I adore all three of these guys. But I would pick Handanovic because, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot about goalkeepers, and, you know, you read interviews sometimes, and a lot of goalkeepers will talk about what a kind of lonely and kind of isolating position it is. I mean, like, obviously during the match, you know, you're by yourself most of the time. But even during training, it's that you have this fundamentally different approach to the game and different role in the game than every other outfield player has. And so there's this kind of psychological distance between you and your teammates, right? And I feel like you learn a lot about a goalkeeper by the way they approach that. Like, I think about a guy like Buffon is really, he sort of takes that isolation and uses it to become like the kind of unquestioned like moral center of the team, you know, just the leader of the team. And then you have a guy like Julio Cesar who almost compensates for it by being like this like super emotional, warm kind of person. I mean, that's what I loved about him, you know, by like the fact that he would like break down in tears like in every single match, you know, no matter what happened. Like if we'd lose, he'd cry. If we won, he'd cry. If we draw, he'd cry. You know, he was great. And he was and you'd watch him like when the team was attacking and he was like almost like this cartoon cheerleader in the back, you know, just like pumping people up. He was great. But like Samir Handanovic, I think, is like a third type in the sense that he seems really comfortable with that kind of isolation. And so it kind of turned himself into like this cyborg of like shot stopping. You know what I mean? Like he has no emotion, you know?
Yeah.
He's like got this liquid metal instead of blood in his veins. And something about that just makes me more confident. You know, like over like the last half decade or whatever, I feel like whenever anyone asks an inner player who their favorite teammate is, the friendliest teammate, the warmest teammate is, they always say Yuta Nagatomo. Like everyone on the team loves Nagatomo. And then on the other side, when people are asked, like, well, who's the quietest guy on the team? Or, like, who's the most intense? Every single one says Samir Handanovic. You know, like, you get the sense that they're almost a little scared of him. That's what I really like about him. And so, like, I mean, he's not perfect, you know? Lots of times he'll parry shots that he should catch, or, you know, sometimes he doesn't deal with, like, corners very well. But I feel like when it comes down to, like, that real essential one-on-one guy with the ball or guy at the penalty spot facing down Handanovic, it's like his eyes just roll back into his head and he becomes this machine. So if I had to stake my life on just sort of that one moment of will the keeper make a move, like I would have to go with Handanovic.
Okay. I think that's a good answer. And I think, you know, Handanovic is the disadvantage. He's never played in the Champions League. So unless you follow Serie A like you and I, you know, you just don't realize how good he is. So, Andrew, Inter's, you know, the top of the standings, excellent start to the season. January window's around the corner. So tell me a little bit what you'd like to see them do. Any areas you'd like to see them bolster the squad a bit?
I mean, honestly, just given the way Spalletti has gotten more underperforming players performing, I really would only go to two positions. One that I think is absolutely necessary and one that's maybe more optional, but I do think, and it's the same thing I thought at the beginning of the season, that we absolutely need a defensive reinforcement, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a miracle that thus far, I think there's only been one match where we have had anything other than our two first choice center backs playing. And to be fair, Andrea Ranocchia against Chievo, that was just about as well as I've ever seen him play in an Inter jersey. I mean, so, you know, full kudos to him and to Spalletti. But still, it's like we're just one, like, twisted ankle away from some really kind of scary situations in defense. So I think we do need that one defensive reinforcement. And then I think that the trickier situation is we could use a new midfielder. But the problem is I don't know who that is. That's clearly the one part of the pitch that there's still a little bit of uncertainty around. Like, I think after a lot of experimentation, he's pretty much settled on Vecino and Gagliardini in midfield, and I like those two. I like the way they play together. Like, Gagliardini is still a little young, and I think he kind of needs to be bailed out once in a while, but I think they have an understanding and they work together. But it's that advanced midfield position, and it's usually Borja Valero, and I think he's very good, but I also feel like Spalletti wants a bit more physicality in that role. You know what I mean? I don't think he's looking for, like, a Wesley Sneijder or, like, a, you know, a Rivera-type player in that advanced position. And Brozovic is the ultimate Jekyll Hyde player. Sometimes he'll get a brace, and sometimes he just seems like he has no interest in playing football whatsoever. And I have no idea what the deal is with João Mario, but there's something missing there. The problem is that, I just don't know who that would be. Like, I think Spalletti wants a guy like Paul Pogba, but clearly we can't afford a guy like that. I know people talk about Ramirez, which would be interesting because he's, you know, owned by Suning, so it'd almost be like transferring your IT guy to Cleveland office or something instead of, like, actually buying a player. But then again, I mean, he's more of a box-to-box type player. He's not exactly a goal machine. I don't know. Like, you know, people talk about Javier Pastore. He seems to have kind of fallen off the map a little bit. I might be wrong there. Mesut Ozil, I don't think is going to happen. And even if it did, like, as great a player as he is, I don't know how he would really fit in the Spalletti system. So there's a clear need there, but I'm not really sure who that would be. So that's why they pay other people the big bucks, I guess.
Yeah, I kind of agree with your take on that. So I think you've already hinted a little bit to this in your previous answer. Like, I have to tell you, after I watched that Napoli match for Juve, and to a lesser extent the Inter one, but I just left, this stretch of games for Juve. They got out of the Champions League. As you mentioned, Allegri's teams always start slow and peak later. To me, it almost feels inevitable that they're going to repeat as champions. Am I, do you kind of agree with that, or do you think Napoli can maybe have a resurgence? It seems you think Inter's a little step behind them. What's your take on the title race as of right now?
Like, I mean, if you were to tell me that Juve are favorites, like, I wouldn't argue with that, because they certainly, I mean, they've got the pedigree and they've got the mentality and they've just done it so many times before. But at the same time, I definitely doesn't feel inevitable. I mean, just because we're in this bizarre situation where there's, you know, with Roma having a game in hand, there's effectively like 2 points separating the top four teams. Yeah. And then Lazio aren't even all that far off in fifth. I mean, that's crazy, you know?
Yeah.
Like in the Bundesliga, I think it's like 10 points separates top four. And then the Premier League, it's like 15 or 16 points. And in Serie A, it's 2. So, I mean, actually, if there's anything that makes me think that Inter could still pull off a Scudetto, it's just the way all of the contenders are bunched up like that. Because that's when you kind of get the randomness factor, where all of these teams are trying to knock each other off. You know, it's like when you're playing Mario Kart and you're on the last lap and like everybody has a turtle shell, you know, so it's just like chaos at the very end. And then whichever one kind of slides through is the one who's lucky enough to win. So I don't know. Inter could be that lucky team, but then again, I always think of the fact that Inter is going to play Lazio on the very last match of the season. And there's really not a great history for Inter playing Lazio at the end of the season when the title's on the line. But I definitely don't think Juve winning is inevitable. I think it's still a real, real toss-up.
Well, I love that Mario Kart analogy. I'll be stealing that one in the future. So now let's transition to pop culture. So I was in Italy when Malcolm Young passed away. If not, you definitely would have gotten a bat signal for that one. So the last time you were on, we were talking about rhythm sections, about Tom Petty, how Jimmy Iovine described Tom Petty's Heartbreakers as being a better rhythm section than Bruce Springsteen's. So I was thinking about that when Malcolm Young passed away. Like, to me, my take on AC/DC is Angus Young's probably a little bit overrated, but everyone else in the band is massively underrated, especially him. I think the rhythm playing in that band was incredible. I know you had a tweet, I think, on how with Malcolm Young, you just really need him as a rhythm section. So tell me a little bit about how you see him historically, and if you can think of other rhythm guitar players who had as much of an impact as he did.
I mean, I think as far as rock and roll, he's right up at the top. You know, when you talk about soul and R&B and disco, then you have to think about rhythm players like Nile Rodgers and Jimmy Nolen and, you know, everyone who played with Stax or with James Brown back in the day. But if you're just talking about rock and roll, I mean, he's right there. Like, I don't think anyone drilled the music down to, like, its numbskull kind of teenage delinquent essence better than him, you know? I mean, I think people talk about Keith Richards when they talk about rhythm players, and that makes a lot of sense. But he's almost, I mean, he's different because he's, like, he almost played lead guitar in the guise of a rhythm guitar player, Keith Richards, you know? Yeah, so like you listen to like Monkey Man off Let It Bleed, and Keith is basically playing the same, like, really basic riff the whole song, but somehow he plays it in like 20 different ways. You know, he just keeps changing the emphasis and changing the timing a little bit. And Malcolm Young was the complete antithesis of that. You know, he is the most solid, least bullshit guitar player who ever lived, just about. You know, I know there's a Angus Young would always talk about Malcolm as, you know, no matter how big and rich and famous as AC/DC got, that Malcolm Young really always saw his job as basically a blue collar 9-to-5 kind of gig, you know. And like the same way you don't want a guy driving a forklift to be getting all artistic and creative with it, you know, Malcolm Young did not want to get weird and improvisatory with his rhythm guitar playing. And I think there's a real underrated value to that. You know, like, I mean, I think about the first note on the first song of the first AC/DC album is just Malcolm Young playing an open A chord, just in like the same rhythm, same one chord for like the first minute and a half of the song, you know? And like I said, like you don't need the bass or the drums there because he's just sitting there holding it down. And so as much as, you know, I mean, whenever you see AC/DC, it's a spectacle, you know, with Angus running around, doing his Three Stooges routine, doing his striptease. But it's all about Malcolm in the back with his face not changing, barely moving, playing the exact same rhythm perfectly every time. So wow. I put him right up at the top of the heap.
Yeah, what a take. I really appreciate your insight into that. So now let's get into Oscar season. So tell me a little bit about your assessment overall of 2017 for movies. I have to be honest, I'm a kind of part of the problem. I don't go to the movies as much as I used to this year. I think I went to see Dunkirk, and then I went to see Lady Bird, not too much else. Mm. So tell me a little bit where you see the industry as a whole, and more importantly, the quality of the films of 2017.
Well, I mean, one of the weird things just from my position, I guess, is that, you know, I mean, I'm lucky enough to get to go to festivals and to get to go to screenings of these movies that kind of barely come out in most of the country. And yeah. I feel like the overall quality of films is as high now as I can ever remember it being. I mean, from, you know, I mean, obviously you have the big blockbusters, but all the way down to these little indie films, you know, which it used to be you'd have to really comb through a lot of crap to get to the good stuff. And now more of it is good stuff than not. The only problem is that no one's seeing them. You know, so many of the best movies I've seen this year barely came out in the theater, if at all. Some just went straight to Netflix, you know. I mean, like, I used to have the experience of going, like, to a Sundance, and I'd see a movie, and then throughout the year, those movies would, like, slowly dribble out, and they'd come out, and some would do well, and some wouldn't do well. But I feel like now I'll go to a festival, and I'll come home, and half of the movies are already on Netflix, and they're just buried somewhere, and the other half just don't even come out at all. Or if they do, I haven't even heard about them. So it's a really interesting and kind of depressing situation where the overall quality is pretty excellent, but as far as getting these films an audience and getting them to really achieve like a critical mass, where it's not just guys like you and me going to see it, but people who just say, oh, that looks interesting. So I think it's a great year for movies, but it's a pretty bad year for movies being part of the culture, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes complete sense. So a movie that I did go to see based on your recommendation was Lady Bird. Absolutely amazing. I cannot recommend this enough. The way I describe it, if you liked Little Miss Sunshine, you're in heaven here. To me, it's even better, even though it doesn't have the junkie grandfather. So really a great film. I loved it. The main actress, I'm probably butchering her name, Saoirse Ronan, really tremendous. Is she basically a lock to win an Oscar for Best Actress, or is there other contenders? And what's your take on the film overall?
I wish that she was a lock to see it and to win it, I mean. And I'm really glad you liked it because, like, it's so weird, but I'm always saying that it's one thing to, like, write a piece saying that everyone should go see a movie. But when someone actually says, hey, you told me to see this movie, I'll go see it, I actually get really nervous. I'm like, shit, he's going to hate this. Like, no one's ever going to listen to me again. Saoirse is, I mean, I think she's like the millennial Meryl Streep, you know what I mean? You know, she was this amazing child actress. And we've really only had, like, just a couple roles from her now that she's in her 20s. But I think both of them, Lady Bird and then earlier with Brooklyn, I mean, I think both of those were like the best performance anyone gave in those years. Mm. But I think she's just a fucking genius as an actress. But she's not a shoo-in as far as like Oscars and the awards and everything. I mean, there's the actual Meryl Streep in The Post, and she could win, which would be the most boring choice imaginable. But, you know, she's Meryl Streep. Frances McDormand was very good in movie I didn't like all that much called Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. But she's great. And actually, Margot Robbie, of all people, was pretty great playing Tonya Harding in this movie, I, Tonya. So I actually wouldn't be mad if she got it. Yeah, it's almost, I mean, like, I'm sure, I mean, I remember really strongly the whole Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan saga. And this almost takes it like a Goodfellas kind of deal.
Really?
It's kind of shot similarly, and she's like surprisingly really, really good in it. So I wouldn't be mad about that. But I still, Saoirse Ronan, I mean, I'm team Saoirse as far as end-of-the-year movies go.
You know, I have to tell you, it makes me feel so old that there's probably some people listening to this podcast that have no idea who Tonya Harding is. And hopefully not my producer, Alex, who's listening right now.
You know, you know what the crazy thing is, though, is that Margot Robbie, the actress who plays her, did not know that this was a real character when she signed on. She thought it was like a
fictional. Well, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The next movie I'm going to go see is Phantom Thread. I'm a huge P.T. Anderson fan. How could you not be a fan of Daniel Day-Lewis? Now, I saw you told me quite a bit about this movie offline. So tell me if Phantom Thread is the best P.T. Anderson movie since There Will Be Blood, and how do you rank this performance for Daniel Day-Lewis? I think this is supposed to be his last movie. I don't know if that's actually true or not. How do you rate his performance compared to his other classics?
That's sort of the pull quote is that, yeah, Phantom Thread, best PTA movie since There Will Be Blood. And it is. But I would add that it's like a very different type of movie. So I feel like P.T. Anderson, he kind of had this early style, like in Magnolia and Heartache and Boogie Nights, which is very, and it's almost like operatic. Like it's these really, really kind of overheated, emotional beats that he hits, and this kind of giant cast sort of coming together in this very musical way. And so I think There Will Be Blood was sort of like the culmination of that style. And since then, he's been doing these really different kinds of movies where it's almost like these puzzles that he makes, and they're puzzles that don't necessarily have an obvious solution. And like The Master was one of those, and I like The Master. And Inherent Vice, I actually was not a huge fan of that movie, but they're both, you can tell he's kind of striving toward a different sort of style. And I feel like Phantom Thread is the best movie he's made in that style, in that it feels more cohesive. Like those other movies felt like he was sort of feeling his way toward the movie as he made it, like kind of making some of it up as he went along. And with Phantom Thread, you really sense that he's going somewhere specific and that he knows where he's taking you. And it's still, there's still a lot of room for interpretation, but I feel like he knows what he's doing with it. And it's also, it's actually weirdly funny, and it's entertaining in a way that I don't think The Master or Inherent Vice were. So it's definitely kind of the best of this sort of middle period PTA, I guess you want to call it. So who knows if this is actually Daniel Day-Lewis's last film. I know he tends to choose his roles carefully, so it'll probably be at least many, many years before we get another one. It's a really interesting performance in that, you know, you think of someone like him, what role he would want to go out on, you know, and you think of like his earlier roles, like Bill the Butcher and Gangs of New York or Daniel Plainview and There Will Be Blood. And they're these very loud kind of archetypal, like forces of nature characters. And the one he plays here is very different. It's not exactly a quiet character, but he's very precise. Like, because he plays this dressmaker in 1950s England. And you almost get this sense, the way he uses his body, it's almost like he is designing his own physical appearance in the same way he would design a dress. So it's just kind of this idea of this man who has just thought through every angle of where he puts his shoulders as kind of adding to the effect, rather than just these big, you know, kind of classical monologues and sort of screaming as oil fields are burning behind him. It's a much kind of more interior performance, but I find it pretty fascinating. Like, I don't know, there's something that he does in this movie where he'll just move like his elbows and his shoulders, and it's like he looks like he's lost 10 pounds in doing so. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's a weirdly kind of physical performance that I found really fascinating. Hopefully that makes sense once you've seen the movie.
Yeah, that'll definitely let you know. And I have to say, to me, there's been no better movie since There Will Be Blood, so I'm very curious to see this one. So another movie that's getting a lot of buzz that I wanted to ask you about is The Shape of Water. So this is the new movie by Guillermo del Toro. Some of you guys might have seen Hellboy, Pan's Labyrinth. So this seems to have got a ton of nominations for the Golden Globe. So tell us a little bit about Shape of Water, and you recommend it, and what can people expect if they go see this?
I definitely recommend it. It's a very good film. I would say, as far as the Guillermo del Toro filmography, it's sort of somewhere between Pan's Labyrinth and Crimson Peak, in the sense that it's fundamentally a love story, and obviously a strange love story, and yet it kind of hinges on one of these real classic Guillermo del Toro creature creations, and it's played by Doug Jones, who is the same guy who played, like, the Pale Man in Pan's Labyrinth, you know, the guy with the eyeballs on his hand. But just to be clear, it's a very strange movie. I mean, it's a movie about a mute woman who falls in love with this half man, half fish creature, and there's definitely woman on fish man sex. So, like, if that doesn't seem like something you want to see with your family over Christmas, you know, fair warning and everything. I found it a kind of sweet, kind of fairy tale like, weirdly sort of heartwarming kind of film. That I would definitely recommend in general.
Oh, excellent. So the last movie I wanted to ask you about before we pick your brain on any other things you recommend we watch is The Post. You hinted a little bit at it. We were talking about the Best Actress race. So this one features Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks. It's a Steven Spielberg movie, mainly on the Watergate investigation at the Washington Post. So tell me a little bit, does this movie maybe hit a bit too close to home with what's going on in politics in the U.S. right now, or did that not even cross your mind? Because I know you're not a huge fan of this film, so give me your take on it overall.
Sure. Well, first, it's actually about the Pentagon Papers, which is a little bit before Watergate. Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, basically every movie about the Washington Post is about Watergate, except for this one. So this moves back just a couple years. It hits very close to home, although I would say that it tries really hard to hit close to home. Like, that's not an accident. There's one speech they have at the end. I mean, no spoilers or anything, but it's basically like, in case you hadn't connected the really obvious dots beforehand, it just goes ahead and connects them for you and says, actually, this is what's happening right now. So I found it kind of lost a little bit of power because of that. But I'm probably being a little cynical because it is really, really relevant to what's going on in this country with an abusive government and the encroachment on the free press. And, you know, Steven Spielberg is probably better than any director who's ever lived at taking something that could seem academic or bloodless and making it feel really emotional. So if he can make people feel strongly about what is happening in this country to the press, then it's a very noble film to come out with. And I almost hesitate to criticize it in that sense, because its intentions are great. But I don't know, I just think to like a movie like Spotlight from a couple years ago, and just how much that movie felt like it respected its audience's intelligence, you know? Like, it really trusted you to follow along and to figure things out. And this one really kind of takes your hand and holds it and explains everything to you, which might actually make it a more impactful film as far as the general audience goes, but for me, it kind of diluted its effect a little bit.
So those were the main movies that I could think about, Andrew. So tell me, anything else you recommend that I, and especially our audience, check out this time of year?
I already said I, Tonya, which is, just because of the podcast we're on, it's a great sports movie in its own way. There's a documentary called Jane, which is fucking great, about Jane Goodall and sort of her earliest trips, you know, to Africa to study chimpanzees. It has this kind of amazing old footage, and it's a Philip Glass score, which really makes it pop. And this is a little more under the radar, even though it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, but there's a film from Sweden called The Square that's just absolutely bonkers. Yeah. It's set in a modern art museum in Stockholm, and it's just weirdly and uncomfortably attuned to the way we talk about delicate subjects and like the way we interact on Twitter and the way we get mad at each other. And I mean, it's a comedy, but it's like a comedy in the style of like Curb Your Enthusiasm, where it'll just take these kind of bizarre situations and keep escalating them and escalating them, and they get more and more uncomfortable, and you're laughing, but you're also like squirming. It's just like, oh God, like finally you're just like, make this stop. But it's really a trip and kind of unlike anything else I've seen this year.
Fantastic. Well, Andrew, this was the best Christmas gift I could ever receive, was having you on talking about all this. So you made my day. Always a pleasure chatting with you. What do you got going on in Variety? What can we expect from you before year end?
I'm taking a vacation, but so, so nothing for me. But things will kick into gear for us starting January. So all sorts of stuff over there. Come check it out if you're into that sort of thing. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure to chat with you. Have a great day, and thanks again.
Anytime.